Really so amazing. You really got under her skin. You know that time when the cholera was in the slum and all? She talked about that for weeks after. She talked about it like it was some kind of holy experience, some kind of transcendental high. And she talked about you a lot. I've never seen her so inspired, I guess.
When Carla got me to rescue you from the palace, I asked, not looking at her. Was that for you? Or was it just a way to score points against Madame Jo?
You mean were we just pawns in Carla's game, you and me? Is that what you're asking?
Something like that.
I think I'd have to say yes, we were.
She pulled her long scarf from her neck and drew it across an open palm, staring at it intently.
Oh, you know, Carla likes me and all. I'm sure about that. She's told me things that nobody knows, not even you. And I like her. And she lived in the States, you know? She grew up there, and she felt something about that. I think I was the only American girl who ever worked at the palace. But the heart of it, deep down, was this war with Madame Jo. I think we got used up, you and me. But it doesn't matter, you know? She got me out of there. You got me out of there, with her. And I'm damn glad. Whatever her reasons were, I don't hold it against her. And I don't think you should either.
I don't, I sighed.
But?
But nothing. We didn't work out, Carla and me, but I...
You still love her?
I turned my head to look at her, but when her blue eyes met mine, I changed the subject. Have you heard anything from Madame Jo?
Not a thing.
Has she been asking questions about you? Anything at all?
Nothing, thank God. It's weird. I don't hate Madame Jo. I don't feel anything for her, one way or the other. Except that I never want to go anywhere near her again. But I do hate her servant, Rajan. If you worked at the palace, he's the one you had to deal with and answer to. His brother takes care of the kitchen, but Rajan looks after the girls. And that's one spooky motherfucker, that Rajan. He gets around like a ghost. It's like he's got eyes in the back of his head. He's the scariest thing in the whole world, let me tell you. Madame Jo, I never even saw. She talks to you through a metal grill. There's at least one in every room, so she can watch what's going on and talk to the girls or the customers. It's a fucking creepy place, Lynn. I'd rather die than go back to that.
There was another silence. Waves pushed at the shoreline of rocks and pebbles at the base of the wall. Seagulls hovered, prowling the wind for signs of things that slithered and scuttled among the rocks.
How much money did he leave you? I'm not sure, she said. I never counted it. It's a lot. 70, 80 grand. A lot more, you know, than Maurizio carved up Modena for and got himself killed for. It's crazy, isn't it?
You should take it and get the fuck out of here.
That's funny. I thought we just signed a 2-year contract with Maeda and his production company. You know, the Let's Get On With Our Lives contract?
Fuck the contract.
Come on, Lynn.
Fuck the contract. You've got to get out of this. We don't know what the fuck's going on. We don't know why Abdullah's dead. We don't know what he did do or what he didn't do. If he wasn't Shapna, then things are bad. If he was Shapna, things are much worse. You should take the money and just go.
And go where?
Anywhere.
Are you going?
No, I've got unfinished business here. And I'm finished myself in a way. But you should go.
You don't get it, do you? She demanded.
It's not about the money. If I go back now, I'll put the lot of it in my arm. I've got to have something more than money. I'm trying to build something here with this business. And I can do it here. I'm something here. I'm somebody. The people look at me when I just walk down the street because I'm different.
You'd be something wherever you are, I said, grinning at her.
Don't make fun of me, Lynn.
I'm not, Lisa. You're a beautiful girl, and you've got heart. That's why people stare at you.
This can work, she insisted. I can feel it in my bones. I don't have any education, Lynn, and I'm not smart like you. I'm not trained to do anything. But this could be big. I could start producing movies maybe one day. I could do something good.
You are good. You'll do good wherever you go.
No. This is my chance. I'm not going back. I'm not going anywhere until I've made it. If I don't do that, if I don't try, then the whole thing will be for nothing. Maurizio and everything else that's happened will be for nothing. If I leave here, I want to do it with my head on straight and a pocket full of money that I earned myself. I looked into the wind, feeling the day alternately warm and cool and warm again on my face and arms as the breeze turned and returned across the bay. A small fleet of fishing canoes drifted past us on their way back to the fishermen's sandy refuge near the slum. I suddenly remembered the day in the rain, sailing in a canoe across the flooded forecourt of the Taj Mahal Hotel and beneath the booming resonant dome of the Gateway Monument. I remembered Vinod's love song and the rain that night as Carla came into my arms. And staring then at the ceaseless, eternal waves, I remembered all that had been lost since that storming night. Prison, torture, Carla gone, Ulla gone, Kadarbai and his council gone, Anand gone, Maurizio dead, Modena probably dead, Rashid dead, Abdullah dead, and Prabhakar. It was impossible. Prabhakar also dead. And I was one of them, walking and talking and staring at the wilding waves, but as dead in my heart as all the rest. And what about you? She asked.
I could feel her eyes on me, and I could hear the emotions in her voice. Sympathy, tenderness, maybe even love.
If I stay, and I'm definitely going to stay, what are you going to do?
I looked at her for a while, reading the runes in her sky-blue eyes. Then I stood from the wall, held her in my arms, and kissed her. It was a long kiss. We lived out a life together in that kiss. We lived and loved and grew old together, and we died. Then our lips parted, and that life we might have had retreated, shrinking to a spark of light we would always recognize in one another's eyes. I could have loved her. Maybe I already did love her a little. But sometimes the worst thing you can do to a woman is to love her. And I still loved Carla. I loved Carla. What am I going to do? I said, repeating her question. I held her shoulders in my hands, keeping her at the distance of my arms. I smiled. I am going to get stoned. I rode away and never looked back. I paid 3 months' rent on my apartment and paid substantial bakshish to the watchman in the car park and the watchman in the building. I kept one good forged passport in my pocket, put all my spare passports and a bundle of cash into a satchel, and left it with my Enfield bullet bike in Didier's care. Then I took a cab to Guptaji's opium den,
near the Street of 10,000 Whores, Shoklaji Street. I climbed the worn wooden steps to the third floor and walked into the cage that junkies build for themselves, one shiny, sharp steel bar at a time. Guptaji provided a large room with 20 sleeping mats and wooden pillows for his opium smokers. For those with special needs, he reserved other rooms behind that open den. Through a very small doorway, I entered the discreet corridor that led to those back rooms. It was so low that I had to stoop, almost to crawling. The room I chose had a cot with a kapok mattress, a weathered carpet, a small cabinet with wickerwork doors, a lamp with a silk lampshade, and a large clay mutka filled with water. The walls on three sides were made from reed matting stretched upon wooden frames. The last wall, at the head of the bed, looked out over a busy street of Arab and local Muslim traders, but its windows were shuttered, so that only a few bright stars of sunlight gleamed in the chinks and gaps. There was no ceiling. Instead, the view overhead was of heavy rafters crossing and joining one another in support of the clay tile roof. I got to know that view very well. Guptaji took money and instructions and left me alone. The room, so close to the roof, was very hot. I took my shirt off and switched off the lamp. The dark little room was like a cell, a prison cell at night. I sat on the bed, and almost at once the tears came. I'd cried before in Bombay. I'd shed tears after I met Ranjit's lepers, and when the stranger had washed my tortured body in Arthur Road Prison, and with Prabhakar's father at the hospital. But that sorrow and suffering had always been stifled. Somehow I'd managed to choke back the worst of it, the flood of it. Then, alone in that little opium cell, with my ruined love for those dead friends, Abdullah and Prabhakar, I let it go. The tears, when they come to some men, are worse than beatings. They're wounded worse by sobbing, men like that, than they are by boots and battens. Tears begin in the heart, but some of us deny the heart so often, and for so long, that when it speaks, we hear not one but 100 sorrows in the heartbreak. We know that crying is a good and natural thing. We know that crying isn't a weakness, but a kind of strength. Still, the weeping rips us root by tangled root from the earth, and we crash like fallen trees when we cry. Guptaji gave me time. When at last I heard the sliding, scuffing sound of his chappals as he approached the door, I smeared the sorrow from my face and switched on the lamp. He'd brought what I'd asked for. A steel spoon, distilled water, disposable syringes, heroin, and a carton of cigarettes. And he set the items out on the little dresser. There was a girl with him. He told me that her name was Shilpa, and that he'd assigned her to me as a servant. She was young, years less than 20, but already scarred with the glum expression of the working professional. Hope, ready to snarl or grovel like a beaten cur, cowered in her eyes. I sent her and Guptaji away and cooked up a taste of heroin. The dose sat in the syringe for almost an hour. I picked it up and put the needle against a fat, strong, healthy vein in my arm 5 times, only to put it down again unused. And for the whole of that sweating hour, I stared at the liquid in the syringe. That was it. The damnation drug. That was the big one. The drug that had driven me to commit stupid, violent crimes. That had put me in prison. That had cost me my family and lost my loved ones. The everything and nothing drug. It takes everything and gives you nothing in return. But the nothing that it gives you, the unfeeling emptiness it gives you, is sometimes all and everything you want. I pushed the needle into the vein, pulled back the rows of blood that confirmed the clean puncture of the vein, and pressed the plunger all the way to the stop. Before I could pull the needle from my arm, the drug made my mind Sahara. Warm, dry, shining, and featureless, the dunes of the drug smothered all thought and buried the forgotten civilization of my mind. The warmth filled my body as well, killing off the thousand little aches, twinges, and discomforts that we endure and ignore in every sober day. There was no pain. There was nothing. And then, with the desert still in my mind, I felt my body drowning, and I broke the surface of a suffocating lake. Was it a week after that first taste? Was it a month? I crawled onto the raft and floated there on the lethal lake in the spoon, carrying the Sahara in my blood. And those rafters overhead, there was a kind of message in them, a message about how and why we all intersected, Kader and Carla and Abdullah and I, our lives, all of us, in the link to Abdullah's death, intersected in some uniquely profound way. It was there, in the rafters, a key to the code. But I closed my eyes. I remembered Prabhakar. I remembered that he was working so hard and so late on the night he died, because he owned the taxi and was working for himself. I'd bought the taxi for him. He'd be alive if I hadn't bought that taxi for him. He was the little mouse that I'd trained and fed with crumbs in my prison cell. The mouse that was crucified. And sometimes the breeze of a clear, unstoned hour gave me an image of Abdullah in the minute before he died, alone in the killing circle. Alone. I should have been there. I was with him every day. I should have been with him then. Friends don't let friends die like that. Alone with death and fate. And where was his body? And what if he was Shapna? Could my friend, the friend I loved, really have been that ruthless, insane mutilator? What did Ghani say? Pieces of Majid's slaughtered body were found all over his house. Could I have loved the man who did that? What did it mean? That some small, insistent part of me feared that he was Shapna and loved him anyway. And I fired the silver bullet into my arm again and fell back on the floating raft. And I saw the answer in the rafters overhead. And I was sure I would understand it with a little more dope, and a little more, and a little more. I woke to see a face glaring at me and speaking fiercely in a language I couldn't understand. It was an ugly face, a scowling face, defined by deep lines that descended in curved chines from his eyes and nose and mouth. Then the face had hands, strong hands, and I found myself lifted from the raft of my bed and propped unsteadily on my feet.
"You come," Nazir growled in English. "You come, now."
"Fuck," I said slowly, pausing for maximum effect. "Off."
"You come," he repeated.
The anger in him was so close to the surface that he trembled with it and opened his mouth unconsciously to bare his teeth in an underbite. "No," I said, turning to the bed once more. "You go." He pulled me around to face him again. There was enormous power in his arms. He clamped the metal grapples of his hands on my arms.
"No, you come."
I'd been 3 months in the room at Guptaji's. They were 3 months of heroin every day and food every other day, and the only exercise a short walk to the toilet and back. I didn't know it then, but I'd lost 12 kilos, the best 30 pounds of muscle on my body. I was thin and weak and still stupid on drugs. "Okay," I said, feigning a smile. "Okay, let me go, will you? I have to get my stuff." He relaxed his grip as I nodded toward the little table where my wallet, watch and passport rested. Guptaji and Shilpa waited in the corridor beyond. I gathered up the possessions and put them into my pockets, pretending to cooperate with Nazir. When I judged the moment to be right, I swung round at him with an overhand right. It should have hit him. It would have hit him when I was healthy and sober. I missed him completely and threw myself off balance. Nazir drove a fist into my solar plexus, just under the heart. I doubled over, winded and helpless, but my knees locked stiffly and my legs wouldn't fold. He raised my head, with his left hand locked into a patch of my hair, pulled his right fist back at shoulder height, hesitated in the precision of his aim, and then rammed his fist into my jaw. The full force of his neck, shoulders and back were in the blow. I saw Guptaji's lips pout and his eyes squint in a wince, and then his face exploded in a shower of sparks that left the world darker than a cave full of sleeping bats. It was the only time in my life I was ever knocked out cold. It seemed that I was falling forever, and the ground was impossibly far away. After a time, I was dimly aware of movement, floating through space, and I thought, it's okay. This is all a dream, a drug dream, and I'm going to wake up any minute now and take more drugs. Then I came down with a rumpled crash on the raft once more. But the raft bed that I'd floated on for 3 long months had changed. It was different somehow. Soft and smooth. And there was a new and wonderful smell. A gorgeous perfume. It was cocoa. I knew it well. It was Carla. It was the perfume on Carla's skin. Nazir had carried me over his shoulder all the way down the flights of stairs and out into the street, where he dumped me in the back seat of a taxi. Carla was there. My head rested in her lap, and I opened my eyes to look into her lovely face. And her green eyes looked back at me with compassion and concern and something else. I closed my eyes, and in the moving darkness, I knew what it was, that something else in her eyes. It was disgust. She was disgusted by my weakness, my heroin habit, my stink of neglect and self-indulgence. Then I felt her hands on my face, and it was like crying, and her fingers moving the caress across my cheek were the tears. When the taxi finally stopped, Nazir carried me up 2 flights of steps as easily as he might have lugged a sack of flour. I came to consciousness again, draped over his shoulder, looking down at Carla as she climbed the steps behind us. I tried to smile at her. We entered a big house through a back door that led to a kitchen. Beyond the large modern kitchen, we came into an enormous open-plan living room, with one wall of glass that looked out upon a golden beach and the dark sapphire sea. Flipping me over his shoulder, Nazir lowered me with more gentleness than I'd expected to a pile of cushions near the glass feature wall. The last hit I'd injected, just before he'd kidnapped me from Guptaji's, was a big dose. Too big. I was groggy and lapsing. The urge to close my eyes and surrender to the stone swept over me in almost irresistible, immersible waves.
"Don't try to get up," Carla said,
kneeling beside me and washing my face with a wet towel. I laughed, because standing was the last thing on my mind. In the laugh I felt the soreness, dimly, through the stone, on the point of my chin and the hinge of my jaw.
"What's going on, Carla?" I asked, hearing my voice crack and warble as I spoke.
3 months of utter silence and soul fog had distorted my speech with dysphasic lapses and creaking fumbles.
"What are you doing here? What am I doing here?"
"Did you think I would leave you there?"
"How did you know?"
How did you find me?
Your friend Cotterby found you. He asked me to bring you here.
He asked you?
Yes,
she said, staring into my eyes with such intensity that it cut through the stone like sunrise piercing the morning's hazy mist.
Where is he?
She smiled, and the smile was sad, because it was the wrong question. I know that now. I'm not stoned now. That was my chance to know the whole of the truth, or as much of the truth as she knew. If I'd asked her the right question, she would have told me the truth. That was the power behind her intense stare. She was ready to tell me everything. She might have even loved me, or begun to love me. But I hadn't asked the right question. I hadn't asked about her. I'd asked about him.
I don't know,
she answered, raising herself with her hands to stand beside me.
He was supposed to be here. I think he'll be here soon. I can't wait, though. I have to go.
What?
I sat up and tried to push the stone curtains aside in order to see her, to speak to her, to keep her with me.
I have to go,
she repeated, walking briskly to the door. Nazir waited for her there, his thick arms jutting out from the swollen trunk of his body.
I can't help it. I've got a lot of things to do before I leave.
Leave? What do you mean, leave?
I'm leaving Bombay again. I've got some work. It's important, and I have to do it. I'll be back in about 6 or 8 weeks. I'll see you then, maybe.
But this is crazy. I don't get it. You should have left me there if you're only going to leave me now.
Look, she said, smiling patiently. I just got back yesterday, and I'm trying not to stay. I'm not even going back to Leopold's. I saw Didier this morning. He says hello, by the way. But that's it. I'm not sticking around. I agreed to help get you out of that little suicide pact you had going with yourself at Guptaji's. Now you're here, you're safe, and I have to go.
She turned and spoke to Nazir. They were speaking Urdu, and I understood only every third or fourth word of their conversation. He laughed, listening to her, and turned to look at me with his customary contempt.
What did he say? I asked her when they fell silent.
You don't want to know.
Yes, I do.
He doesn't think you'll make it, she replied. I told him that you'll do cold turkey here and be waiting for me when I come back in a couple of months. He doesn't think so. He says you'll run out of here to get a fix the first minute the turkey begins. I made a bet with him that you'd make it.
How much did you bet?
$1,000.
$1,000, I mused. It was an impressive stake against the odds.
Yes, it's all the cash he has, a kind of nest egg. He's betting it all that you'll break down. He says you're a weak man. That's why you take drugs.
What do you say?
She laughed, and it was so rare to see and hear her laugh that I took those bright, round syllables of happiness into me like food, like drink, like the drug. Despite the stone and the sickness, I knew with perfect understanding that the greatest treasure and pleasure I would ever know was in that laugh. To make that woman laugh and feel the laughter bubbling from her lips against my face, my skin.
I told him, she said, that a good man is as strong as the right woman needs him to be.
Then she was gone, and I closed my eyes. And an hour or a day later, I opened them to find Kadarbai sitting beside me.
Udna hai, I heard Nazir's voice say.
He's awake. I woke, unwell.
I woke alert and cold and needing heroin. My mouth was filthy, and my body ached everywhere at once.
Carter murmured. You have the pain already.
I pulled myself up on the pillows and looked around the room. It was the beginning of evening, and night's long shadow was creeping across the sandy beach beyond the window. Nazir sat on a piece of carpet near the entrance to the kitchen. Kader was dressed in the loose pantaloons, shirt, and tunic vest of the Pathans. The clothes were green, the favourite colour of the Prophet. He looked older somehow, after just those few months. He also looked fitter and more calm and determined than I'd ever seen him.
Do you need food? He asked,
when I stared at him without speaking.
Do you want to take your bath? There is everything here. You can bath as often as you like. You can eat food. There is plenty. You can put on new clothes. I have them for you.
What happened to Abdullah? I demanded.
You must get well.
What the fuck happened to Abdullah?
I shouted, my voice breaking. Nazir watched me. He was outwardly calm, but I knew that he was ready to spring.
What do you want to know?
Kader asked gently, avoiding my eyes and nodding his head slowly as he stared at the carpet between his crossed knees.
Was he Shapna?
No,
he replied, turning to meet my hard stare.
I know the people say this, but I give you my word that he was not Shapna.
I exhaled a full breath in an exhausted sigh of relief. I felt tears stinging my eyes, and I bit the inside of my cheek to kill them.
Why did they say he was Shapna?
Abdullah's enemies made the police believe that he was.
What enemies? Who are they?
Men from Iran. Enemies from his country.
I remembered the fight, the mysterious fight. Abdullah and I, we'd fought with a group of Iranian men on the street. I tried to remember other details from that day, but I couldn't think past the sharp, guilty twist of regret that I'd never asked Abdullah who the men were or why we'd fought them.
Where's the real Shapna?
He is dead. I found the man, the real Shapna. Now he is dead. That much is done for Abdullah.
I relaxed against the cushions and closed my eyes for a moment. My nose was beginning to run, and my throat was clogged and sore. I'd built up a big habit in those 3 months. 3 grams of pure Thai white heroin every day. The turkey was coming on fast, and I knew that it would be 2 weeks in Hell's Punishment Unit.
Why?
I asked him after a time.
What do you mean?
Why did you find me? Why did you have him, Nazir, bring me here?
You work for me, he answered, smiling. And now I have a job of work for you to do.
Well, I'm afraid I'm not up to it just at the minute.
The cramps were creeping into my stomach. I groaned and looked away.
Oh, yes, he agreed. You must be well first. But then, in 3 or 4 months, you will be the right man to do this job for me.
What kind of a job?
It is a mission. A kind of holy mission, you might call it. Do you know how to ride a horse?
A horse? I don't know anything about horses. If I can do the job on a motorcycle, when I get well, if I get well, I'm your man.
Nazir will teach you to ride. He is, or he was, the best horseman in a village of men who are the best horsemen in Nangarhar province. There are horses stabled near here.
and you can learn to ride on the beach.
Learn to ride, I muttered, wondering how I was going to survive the next hour, and the hour after that, and the worst that would come.
Oh yes, Linbaba, he said,
reaching out with the smile and touching my shoulder with his palm. I flinched at the touch and shivered, but the warmth of his hand seemed to enter me, and I was still.
You cannot reach Kandahar in any other way but by horse at this time, because the roads are all mined and bombed. So you see, when you go with my men to the war in Afghanistan, you must know how to ride a horse.
Afghanistan?
Yes.
What the hell makes you think I'm going to Afghanistan?
I don't know if you will do it or not, he replied,
with what seemed to be genuine sadness.
I'm going on this mission myself. To Afghanistan, my home, that I have not seen for more than 50 years. And I am inviting you, I am asking you, to go with me. The choice, of course, is yours to make. It is a dangerous job, that much is certain. I will not think less about you if you decide not to go with me.
Why me?
I need a Gora, a foreigner, who is not afraid to break a large number of international laws, and who can pass for an American. Where we will go, there are many rival clans, and they have fought with one another for hundreds of years. They have long traditions of raiding one another and taking whatever they can as plunder on their raids. Only two things unite them, just at this time. Love for Allah, and hatred for the Russian invaders. At the moment, their chief allies against the Russians are the Americans. They are fighting with American money and American weapons. If I have an American with me, they will leave us alone and let us pass without molesting us or stealing more than a reasonable amount from us.
Why don't you get an American? A real one, I mean.
I tried. I could not find one crazy enough to take the risk. That is why I need you.
What are we smuggling on this mission to Afghanistan?
The usual things that one smuggles into a war. Guns, explosives, passports, money, gold, machine parts, and medicines. It will be an interesting journey. If we pass through the heavily armed clans who would like to take what we have, we will deliver our goods to a unit of Mujahideen fighters who are putting siege to Kandahar city. They have been fighting the Russians in the same place for 2 years, and they need the supplies.
Questions writhed in my shivering mind, hundreds of them, but the cold turkey was crippling me. Cold, greasy sweat from the struggle smothered my skin. The words, when they came at last, were rushed and faltering. Why are you doing this? Why Kandahar? Why there?
The Mujahideen, the men at the siege of Kandahar, they are my people, from my village. They are from Nazir's village also. They are fighting a jihad, a holy war, to drive the Russian invaders out of the homeland. We have helped them in many ways up to this time. Now it is time to help them with guns. And with my blood, if it is necessary.
He looked at the sickness trembling across my face and cutting facets from my eyes. He smiled again, pressing his fingers into my shoulder until that pain, that touch, his touch, was all I felt for a moment.
First, you must be well, he said,
releasing the pressure of his fingers and touching his palm to my face.
Allah be with you, my son. Allah yafazak.
When he left me, I went to the bathroom. Stomach cramp stabbed me with eagle's claws, then twisted my insides with talons of agony. Diarrhea shook me with convulsive spasms. I washed myself, shivering so violently that my teeth clattered together. I looked in the mirror and saw my eyes, the pupils so large that the whole iris was black. When the light comes back, when the heroin stops and the turkey starts and the light returns, it rushes in through the black funnels of the eyes. Wearing a towel around my waist, I walked back to the big main room. I looked thin. I was stooped and shivering and moaning involuntarily. Nazir looked me up and down with a sneer curling his thick upper lip. He handed me a pile of clean clothes. They were exact copies of Kader's green Afghan costume. I dressed, shaking and trembling and losing my balance a few times. Nazir watched me, his knotty fists balled at his hips. The sneer rippled his lip like the opening ridges of a clamshell. His every gesture was so loud and broad that it had the exaggeration of pantomime. But his dark eyes were fierce with menace. I suddenly realized that he reminded me of the Japanese actor Toshiro Mifune. He was an ugly, troll-like caricature of Mifune. "Do you know Toshiro Mifune?" I asked him through a desperate, pain-smeared laugh. "You know Mifune, huh?" His answer was to walk to the front door of the house and throw it open. He pulled some 50-rupee notes from his pocket and hurled them onto the floor.
"Ja, Bainjud," he snarled,
pointing out the open door. "Go, sister fucker." I staggered to the pile of cushions heaped against the great window and collapsed there. I pulled a blanket over myself, cringing in the flaying wrench and cramp of the craving. Nazir closed the door of the house and took up his position on the patch of carpet, sitting cross-legged and straight-backed as he watched me. We all cope with anxiety and stress, to one degree or another, with the help of a cocktail of chemicals produced in the body and released in the brain. Chief among them is the endorphin group. The endorphins are peptide neurotransmitters that have pain-relieving properties. Anxiety and stress and pain bring on the endorphin response as a natural coping mechanism. When we take any of the opiates, morphine or opium, or heroin in particular, the body stops producing endorphins. When we stop taking opiates, there's a lag of between 5 and 14 days before the body begins a new endorphin production cycle. In the meanwhile, in that black, tortured crawl space of 1 to 2 weeks without heroin and without endorphins, we learn what anxiety and stress and pain really are. "What's it like?" Carla asked me once. "Cold turkey off heroin." I tried to explain it. "Think about every time in your life that you've ever been afraid, really afraid. Someone sneaks up behind you when you think you're alone and shouts to frighten you. The gang of thugs closes in around you. You fall from a great height in a dream, or you stand on the very edge of a steep cliff. Someone holds you underwater, and you feel the breath gone, and you scramble, fight, and claw your way to the surface. You lose control of the car, and see the wall rushing into your soundless shout. Then add them all up, all those chest-tightening terrors, and feel them all at once, all at the same time, hour after hour, and day after day. And think of every pain you've ever known, the burn with hot oil, the sharp sliver of glass, the broken bone, the gravel rash when you fell on the rough road in winter, the headache and the earache and the toothache. Then add them all up, all those groin-squeezing, stomach-tensing shrieks of pain, and feel them all at once, hour after hour and day after day. Then think of every anguish you've ever known. Remember the death of a loved one. Remember a lover's rejection. Recall your feelings of failure and shame and unspeakably bitter remorse. And add them all up, all the heart-stabbing griefs and miseries, and feel them all at once, hour after hour and day after day. That's cold turkey. Cold turkey off heroin is life with the skin torn away. The assault of anxiety on the unprotected mind, the brain without natural endorphins, makes men and women mad. Every junkie going through turkey is mad.
The madness is so fierce and cruel that some die of it. And in the temporary insanity of that skinned, excruciated world, we commit crimes. And if we survive, years later, and become well, our healthy recollection of those crimes leaves us wretched, bewildered, and as self-disgusted as men and women who betray their comrades and country under torture. 2 full days and nights into the torment, I knew I wasn't going to make it. Most of the vomiting and the diarrhea had passed, but the pain and anxieties were worse, much worse, every minute. Beneath the screaming in my blood, there was a calm, insistent voice. You can stop this. You can fix this. You can stop this. Take the money. Get a fix. You can stop this pain. Nazia's bamboo and coconut fiber cot was in the far corner of the room. I lurched towards it, watched closely by the burly Afghan, who was still sitting on his mat near the door. Trembling and moaning with pain, I dragged the cot closer to the great window that looked out on the sea. I took up a cotton sheet and began to tear at it with my teeth. It gave way in a few places, and I ripped it along the length, tearing off strips of cloth. Frantic in my movements and close to panic, I hurled 2 thick embroidered quilts onto the rope bed for a mattress and lay down on it. Using 2 of the strips, I tied my ankles to the bed. With a 3rd strip, I secured my left wrist. Then I lay down and turned my head to look at Nazir. I held out the remaining strip and asked him with my eyes to bind my arm to the bed. It was the first time that we'd ever met one another's eyes in an equally honest stare. He rose from his square of carpet and walked toward me, holding the stare. He took the strip of cloth from my hand and bound my right wrist to the frame of the bed. A shout of trapped, panic fear escaped from my open mouth, and another. I bit down on my tongue, biting through the flesh at the sides until blood ran past my lips. Nazir nodded slowly. He tore another thick strip from the sheet and twirled it into a corkscrew tube. Sliding it between my teeth, he tied the gag behind my head. And I bit down on the devil's tail, and I screamed. And I turned my head to see my own reflection tied to the night in the window. And for a while, I was Modena, waiting and watching and screaming with my eyes. 2 days and nights I was tied to the bed. Nazir nursed me with tenderness and constancy. He was always there. Every time I opened my eyes, I felt his rough hand on my brow, wiping the sweat and the tears into my hair. Every time the lightning strike of cramp twisted a leg or arm or my stomach, he was there, massaging warmth into the knot of pain. Every time I whimpered or screamed into the gag, he held my eyes with his, willing me to endure and succeed. He removed the gag when I choked on a trickle of vomit or my blocked nose let no air pass. But he was a strong man, and he knew that I didn't want my screams to be heard. When I nodded my head, he replaced the gag and tied it fast. And then, when I knew that I was either strong enough to stay or too weak to leave, I nodded to Nazir, blinking my eyes, and he removed the gag for the last time. One by one, he untied the bonds at my wrists and ankles. He brought me a broth made from chicken and barley and tomatoes, unspiced, except for salt. It was the richest and most delicious thing I ever tasted in my life. He fed it to me, spoon by spoon. After an hour, when I finished the little bowl, he smiled at me for the first time. And that smile was like sunlight on sea rocks after summer rain. Cold turkey goes on for about 2 weeks, but the first 5 days are the worst. If you can get through the first 5 days, if you can crawl and drag yourself into that 6th morning without drugs, you know you're clean, and you know you'll make it. Every hour for the next 8 to 10 days, you feel a little better and a little stronger.
The cramps fade, the nausea passes, the fever and chills subside. After a while, the worst of it is simply that you can't sleep. You lie on the bed at night, twisting and writhing in discomfort, and sleep never comes. In those last days and very long nights of the turkey, I became a standing bubba. I never sat or lay down, all day and all night, until exhaustion collapsed my legs at last, and I sank into sleep. And it passes. The turkey passes, and you emerge from the cobra bite of heroin addiction, like any survivor from any disaster. Dazed, wounded forever, and glad to be alive. Nazir took my first sarcastic jokes 12 days after the turkey began, as the cue for my training to commence. From the 6th day, I'd been walking with him as light exercise, and for the fresh air. The first of those walks had been slow and halting, and I'd returned to the house after 15 minutes. By the 12th day, I was walking the length of the beach with him, hoping to tire myself so much that I could sleep. Finally, he took me to the stable where Cardo's horses were kept. The stable was a converted boathouse, one street away from the beach. The horses were trained for beginning riders and carried tourists up and down the beach in the high season. The white gelding and grey mare were large, docile animals. We took them from Cardo's stable master and led them down to the flat, hard-packed sand of the beach. There's no animal in the world with a deeper sense of parody than a horse. A cat can make you look clumsy, and a dog can make you look stupid, but only a horse can make you look both at the same time. And then, with nothing more than the flick of a tail or a casual stomp on your foot, it lets you know that it did it on purpose. Some people know from the first contact with the animal that they'll ride well and bond with the beast. I'm not one of those people. A friend of mine has a strange anti-magnetic effect on machines. Watches stop on her wrist, radio receivers crackle, and photocopy machines glitch whenever she's near. My relationship with horses is something like that. The thick-set Afghan cupped his hands to boost me onto the gelding's back, nodding his head for me to climb up, and winking encouragingly. I put my foot into his hands and sprang up onto the white horse. But in the instant that I sat on its back, the previously meek, well-trained creature hurled me off with a prodigious arching kick. I soared over Nazir's shoulder and landed with a thump on the sand. The gelding galloped away down the beach without me. Nazir stared after it, gape-mouthed. The animal was only calmed and returned to my presence when he fetched a blinding bag and placed it over its head. That was the beginning of Nazir's slow, reluctant acceptance of the fact that I would never be anything other than the worst horseman he knew. The disappointment should have plunged me deeper into the well of his contempt, but in fact it provoked an opposite reaction. In the weeks that followed, he became solicitous and even tender-hearted toward me. For Nazir, that stumbling ineptitude with horses was a terrible affliction, as pitiable in a man as a painfully debilitating illness. And even at my best, when I managed to remain on the horse for minutes at a time and work the beast in a circle by flapping my legs at its sides and yanking with both hands at the bridle, my gracelessness moved him close to tears. Nevertheless, I persevered with the lessons, and I exercised every day. I worked my way up to 20 sets of 30 push-ups, with a minute rest between each set. I followed the push-ups every day with 500 sit-ups, a 5-kilometer run, and a 40-minute swim in the sea. After almost 3 months of the routine, I was fit and strong. Nazir wanted me to gain some experience at riding over rough terrain, so I arranged with Chandra Mehta for us to visit the riding range at the Film City Movie Studio Ranch. Many of the feature films had horse and rider sequences. The teams of horses were cared for by squads of men who lived on the vast tracts of hilly land and were on call for stunt and action scenes. The animals were superbly well trained, but barely 2 minutes after Nazir and I had mounted the brown mares assigned to us, My horse threw me into a stack of clay pots. Nazir took up the reins of my horse and sat in his saddle, shaking his head pityingly.
"Hey, great stunt, yeah!"
one of the stunt men called out. There were five of them riding with us, and they all laughed. Two men jumped down to help me up. Two falls later, as I climbed wearily into the saddle, I heard a familiar voice. I looked around to see a group of riders. At their head was a cowboy looking like Emiliano Zapata, with a black hat hanging on his back from a leather thong.
"I fucking knew it was you!" Vikram shouted.
He drew his horse up close to mine and shook my hand warmly. His companions joined Nazir and our stunt riders, and they trotted away, leaving us alone.
"What are you doing here?"
"I own the fucking place, man."
He spread his arms wide.
"Well, not exactly. Letty bought a share as a partner with Lisa."
"My Lisa?" He raised one eyebrow quizzically.
"Your Lisa?
You know what I mean."
"Sure," he said, grinning widely. "Her and Letty, you know, they're running that casting agency together. The one you guys started up. And they're doing all right, man. They're good together. I decided to get in on it as well. Your friend, Chandra Mehta, told me there was a share going in the stunt stable. Hey, it's a natural for me, wouldn't you say?"
"Oh, no doubt about that, Vikram.
So, I put some damn money in it, and now I come out here every week. I'm an extra in a fucking movie tomorrow. Come and watch me get shot, brother."
"It's a tempting offer," I said, laughing with him. "But I'm leaving town for a while tomorrow."
"You're leaving? For how long?"
"I don't know exactly. A month, maybe longer."
"Then you'll be back?"
"Sure. Keep a video of the stunt. When I get back, we'll get stoned and watch you get killed in slow motion."
"Ha! You got a deal. Come on, let's ride together, man."
"No, no," I shouted. "I'll never get this horse to ride with you, Vikram. I'm the worst rider you ever saw. I've already fallen off this one three times. If I can get it to walk in a straight line, I'll be happy."
"Come on, Brother Lin. I tell you what, I'll lend you my hat. It never fails, man. It's a lucky hat. You're having trouble because you got no hat."
I don't think the hat's gonna cover it, man."
"It's a fucking magic hat, man, I'm telling you."
"You haven't seen me ride.
And you haven't worn the hat. The hat can fix anything. Plus, you're a Gora. No offense to your whiteness, yeah? But these are Indian horses, man. They just need to get a little Indian style from you, that's all. You speak in Hindi to them and dance a little, then you'll see."
"I don't think so."
"Sure, man. Come on, get down and dance with me."
"What?"
"Come on and dance with me."
"I'm not dancing for the horses, Vikram," I declared, with as much dignity and sincerity as I could pack into the bizarre string of words.
"Sure you will. You get down with me now and dance a little Indian magic. The horses have to see that cool Indian motherfucker you got inside your tight, white exterior, man. I swear, the horses will love you, and you'll ride like Clint fucking Eastwood."
"I don't want to ride like Clint fucking Eastwood."
"Yes, you do," he laughed. "Everybody does."
"No, I'm not doing it."
"Come on."
"No way." He climbed down and began to prise my boots from the stirrups. Exasperated, I climbed down and stood next to him, facing the two horses.
"Like this," Vikram said,
shaking his hips and stepping out in a movie dance routine. He began to sing, clapping his hands in time.
"Come on, yeah! Put some India into it, man! Don't go all fucking European on me!"
There are three things that no Indian man can resist: a beautiful face, a beautiful song, and an invitation to dance. I was Indian enough, in my crazy white way, to dance with Vikram, even if it was simply that I couldn't bear to see him dance alone. Shaking my head and laughing despite myself, I joined in his routine. He guided me through the dance, adding new steps until we had the turns and walks and gestures in perfect time together. The horses watched us with that peculiarly equine mix of white-eyed timorousness and snorting condescension. Still, we danced and sang to them in that grand